one final passage from Kant's Reflections that Allison quotes on page 28 at the top. He says, "This general validity presupposes a comparison not of perceptions, but of our apprehension, insofar as it contains the presentation of an as yet undetermined concept and is universal in itself." Read that again. Very peculiar. Because we have to figure out what he means by universal in itself. What is universal in itself? The passage again is, "The general validity presupposes a comparison, not of perceptions, but of our apprehension, insofar as it contains the presentation of an as yet undetermined concept and is universal in itself." So the presentation in the apprehension is what is universal in itself. So what gets compared with what are various acts of apprehension, or better still, what gets compared with what are the contents of various acts of apprehension. And they are compared with respect to their presentation or exhibition of an as yet undetermined concept. So again, the notion of presentation is pointing towards the notion of a schema, then indeed what is compared is between the schemata of concepts not yet formed. And this is claimed as the basis of concept formation. The puzzle, what's going to make the whole thing work, if it works at all, is that the content of these acts of apprehension, the content of these acts of apprehension contains something universal in itself. So this is to say that not only in the production of an image corresponding to a concept, but in the apprehension of an object, there must be something universal involved. And the strangeness, the reason why we are suffering here, is because we are making a massive assumption. And our massive assumption is that concepts have universality and intuitions, which are what are apprehended, are particular. Which is to say, anything that is mind-like, lo and behold, belongs to the mind, and everything that is in the world is merely a dumb particular. That has to be wrong. That's the mistake. One might even say it's the mistake of idealism, which is to say this is an anti idealist argument of a kind. For what Kant is here denying is this dualism, the schema, and the reason why he keeps talking about the notion of schema with respect to apprehension is the very idea of sensible generality. And we have a lot of different terms for the notion of sensible generality. The one that is all over the third critique is the word form. Form is a version of sensible generality. The word I have been using is patterning. So what we are talking about is the notion of what is invisible in the sensibly visible that is not yet a concept. And what is invisible in the sensibly visible that is not yet a concept, but is a condition of application, is sensible generality. So the entire work of the Critique of Judgment is in fact a critique of concept intuition dualism. The concept intuition dualism is, of course, the structure of Platonic dualism, that is, the structure of the gap between the intelligible and the sensible, between the universal all on one side, the particular all on the other, mind is here, body as merely causal, as if bodies were not themselves formed. So the argument is that in order for concept acquisition to be possible, there must be sensible generality in the world. That is, there must be patternings in the world that are not yet causal, not yet law-like, not yet conceptually determined, but nonetheless of such a distinct quality that we cannot, as it were, as we gaze upon them, deny that there is, let's say, some sensible integrity to what we apprehend. So the basis, what is presupposed for the possibility of concept formation, is the existence not of, and the strong thesis, by the way, is itself Platonic. The strong thesis, which is in John McDowell, is he says, nature is cut at the joints, right? There's just this one articulation of nature. And for poor McDowell, his problem is to explain conceptual differences, right? Because for him, it should all be, you know, and he tries using second nature to do that. But basically, in his heart, he's a Platonist. Very concrete Platonist, but a Platonist. Kant's notion of reflective judgment is trying to get at the possibility of there being sufficient patterning in the world so that the business of concept formation and acquisition can occur without that patterning or forming determining how conceptuality will run. So he is trying to find, as I may put it, a moment of something that stands between strong rationalistic Platonism on the one hand and nominalism on the other. And the notion of reflective judgment is the first attempt that I'm aware of in the history of philosophy to try to fill in exactly that space. That is neither to go, I'm just guessing here, I just said that, I have no idea. I'm looking at Stephen because he's supposed to know. Stahl, is there something else earlier?
Aristotle.
I think Aristotle does it. Maybe. Using the same kind of problem, though. Same kind of issue of sensible generality. Yeah. I think that might be right. And therefore Aquinas, given that he's a... So, that would be a way of going it. But Kant's trying here to resist both Platonism and strong nominalism and show that there are presuppositions. Think of it this way. This is the problem. One way of Kant's problem is how can we, he says, how can we assume that there's not so wild heterogeneity that we'll never be able to form any concept? Here's a different version of the same problem, and I think a deeper one. We like to think that our concepts are not mere reflections of how we think about the world, but in some sense get at how the world is. So the question raised by the problem of reflective judgment, again, is how does the world have a speaking voice in the world of judgment and reason? How does the world speak? Right? And it's not an accident that later on in this book, Kant will say that nature speaks in ciphers. He will actually have nature speaking. And the hidden language of nature is what aesthetics gets at. So what we want, if we thought that all of our conceptual inquiry, all of science, was just our imposition, right? This is Nietzsche. Just an imposition of our mind on the world, then we would be deeply uninterested in knowing about the world. Right? Nietzsche has no account of why anyone would bother looking at the world to know anything, since it seems as if, right, it's all metaphors, we can say whatever we want. Can't be right. And Kant became anxious that his own account was exactly because he says the mind legislates for nature. The mind dictates and doesn't ask. And then he began, in the third critique on claiming, to have cold feet because he began to think, wait a minute, I don't want to say we merely legislate. I want to know that our works of concept formation, scientific inquiry, actually touch the world. And this problem of concept formation is that moment where we're asking the question, how does nature play a not merely causal role? Right? That, by the way, is Karl Popper's answer, right? Nature is dumb. The only thing that nature can say is no. That's Popper's theory of conjectures and refutations. We come up with hypotheses, we test them, He says it doesn't matter if we ever get good answers. They don't count. The only thing that counts, Popper says, is when nature says no. Why does he think that? Because he thinks that there's no way we can touch nature except causally, namely when it kicks back, which is to say, for Popper, nature is intrinsically dumb. Right? Well, that is what Kant is refusing. So the assumption of the transcendental principle of reflective judgment is again the principle of the purposiveness of nature. So, page 211 in the first introduction, Kant says, again, the very, very end of it, the very beginning of 212, he says, the principle by which we reflect on given objects of nature is this: that for all natural things, concepts can be found, and this is the crux. Of course, concepts can be found that are determined empirically, i.e. not by will, not by convention, not by agreement, not by imposition, not by metaphor, but empirically. Very quiet.
I mean,
But
so far as we have how common are we rather than
say more. Say how you want it to be louder.
I don't want it to be louder. I want it to be quieter, but
even quieter still?
I don't know. But I just mean that in other words, why not just go all the way and say that the principles of reflective judgment can become constitutive in some sense?
Because then you've got legislation by the mind alone. Then you've actually turned it back into rationalism.
Right.
Exactly what we're trying to avoid. The genius of this, right, is to both get some sense of what it is we want from concepts, but not supposing that we can legislate that. So the delicacy, so my question to you is actually, I think, if there's a genius to this book, that's the genius. Let it not be too quiet or too loud. Right? Which is to say, this is a way of avoiding both empiricism, too quiet, and rationalism, too noisy. That's just, so this is perfectly Kantian in its inspiration, but it's Kant now turning against a certain naive conception of what idealism means. Okay, so the structure of the argument that I've been trying to run here is that there is, in fact, a deep parallel between the solution to the problem of law-likeness in science and the problem of the potential orderliness of nature as a whole, the one that Kant uses for scientific inquiry, and the problems of the possibility of empirical concept acquisition. So I am bound to say, if I can put it in my three levels, right? Individual, concepts, science, that level three presupposes level two. Right? That's what I've been arguing for the last hour and a half. That's all I've been arguing. Level three presupposes level two. Yeah.
Are you sure Kant is worried about this change? It seems to me that he wasn't really thinking in those terms at all. I wanted to think that that kind of embodied order was noumenal, and the depth of the soul and so on. So you only wanted the rationalistic version of it. And the Quirius question, and not so much this question.
So it matters to my account. Perfectly right question. So just to remind everyone about exactly why I said that there's an archaeology to the composition of the third critique, namely, first comes the problems of aesthetic judgment, second came the composition of the idea of reflective judgment, and only very late did he come on the problem of ethics in the substratum. So I am claiming that the problem, and this is why I am sticking with the first introduction for the moment, in the first introduction, I am convinced that this is a problem. The question about whether it lasts into the published text is a real issue. So I will be reading the published text of the third critique through the lens of the first introduction. The first introduction differs in spirit because in it, the problem of ethics, the substratum, all that, doesn't yet have its full-blown character that it has in the final text in the second introduction. That's certainly one of the differences. So it's the right question. My view is Kant changed his mind, that he had an inkling of this problem and then thought he'd have a better way of dealing with it, namely the problem of, and I agree, heavily metaphysical notion of substrate. So I will be giving, again, a heterodoxical reading of the text. I'm using Kant as a critique of Kant. That's my strategy. Okay. We have yet to solve the problem of level one, the individual qua individual. We're still in the first introduction. We're not going to even finish it today. The awareness of particulars as such in their particularity. And I guess what I am going to be hypothesizing is the resolution of this difficulty, and of this difficulty alone, of what it is to be aware of an individual, it will be the work of aesthetic reflective judgment. But if that is true, then I will equally want to say that not only that level 3 presupposes level 1, but I really do want to argue finally, and this is, by the way, what Allison and Guire reject for reasons I'll come to, that level 2 presupposes level 1. So the three levels I had on the board, I mean to have as a series of structured presuppositions governing the logic of the argument as a whole, and what gives it its power, and above all, the way I'm reading it, is the way in which all the German idealists read it. So I am, as it were, reading of the text is the way in which that text suddenly appears as it gets picked up by Schiller, by Herderlin, by Hegel, by the Schlegels. Well, the thought then is when we, in order to push just what I mean by this level 2 presupposes level 1, is that we can only fully comprehend the moment of reflection presupposed by each determinate judgment by having an aesthetic level. That the aesthetic will be, as it were, shall I say, the foundation, the empirical foundation of it all. That our aesthetic encounter with the world is the condition of possibility for our cognitive encounter with the world, but that's because what I'm going to call the aesthetic encounter with the world is already going to be pretty cognitive. Again, Kant has problems with how cognitive it is, and we'll have debates about that. Here, at any rate, one way of beginning to get at this idea is a passage I am fond of, that makes everyone deeply uneasy, which is, I guess, why I'm fond of it. And it occurs in the second, the published introduction, at page 187. Toward the end of page 187, Kant says, it is true that we no longer feel any noticeable pleasure resulting from our being able to grasp nature and the unity in its division into genre and species that alone makes possible the empirical concepts by means of which we cognize nature in terms of particular laws. But this pleasure was no doubt there at one time. And it is only because even the commonest experience would be impossible without it that we have gradually come to mix it in with mere cognition and no longer take any special notice of it. This is the hypothesis of what I call the lost pleasure of cognition. And Kant is here assuming that when we walk around the world and say, you know, bottle, watch, book, that our capacity to bring things under concepts doesn't bring us any particular satisfaction, is just the way we instrumentally get our way around the world, which is to say we experience the world, as I said earlier, as already completely conceptualized, as there's no space between concept and object. Right? So part of the depth of this book, right, is we actually experience the world as the concept of relation as tightly put together as possible. The whole book is trying to open a space between concept and object in order to see the history of how they once got together. So this whole book is a kind of genealogical, archaeological account of the history by means of which we have come to a conceptual determination of the world. Now, in putting it that way, and that Kant is going to suggest that when we originally, or he's suggesting in this passage, that when we originally faced the world collectively, we experience it as chaotic. The way small children experience it as chaotic. And just the way in which watch a baby, that is someone learning language, age 2, 3, when they not get a concept, but when, for the first time, they reapply it, that is, the same again. The thrill of that is when they recognize that something that they have already experienced has come back. And of course, even when they're wrong, right? You know, they have the notion of grandmother, and then any big, fat, hopeless woman, you know, grandma, right? Doesn't matter. Now, what this pleasure is combined of two things. Of course, part of the pleasure is sheer mastery. The pleasure of being successful in the act of ordering. But there is a flip side to that, Namely, there is a pleasure in discovering the amenability of nature as such to our powers of ordering. That is, it's as if suddenly the world conspired to make it possible for me to name it. And the pleasure, therefore, is both a pleasure in ordering and a pleasure in the order found. Or as I sometimes put it, there is this tension between discovery and creation. And here now is the hypothesis that the amenability of nature to our powers in general, in our experience of particular presentations, is perhaps the pleasure found in aesthetics, in judgments of natural beauty. That in natural beauty, we are, as it were, becoming aware that nature, without any imposition of our conceptuality on it, without any demanding of what we are to find, suddenly appears as if it was there beckoning our minded relationship to it to become involved with it. As if it was not, we are not only attuned to it, but it's our attunement to it is permitted by its attunement to us. So that what natural beauty, and one of the great debates around Kant we're going to come to is, why is his account about primarily natural beauty and only derivatively about artistic beauty? And some of the reason for that is what I'm suggesting now, that in its Kantian conception, the experience of beauty is the experience of the amenability of nature in general to our capacities for cognition in general without any active willing of that attunement. So we might say it's a discovery of the attunement between mind and world and the delight in that. So all beauty is a return of the repressed. And that will become repressed nature. Nature that's been repressed by our conceptuality has been overly humanized. We've lost touch with it. So we are walking around as if our concepts are it. And then we discover there's more to nature than we thought. But lo and behold, it's still amenable to us. Or, completely hostile, which we call the sublime. Yeah?
Is that what you mentioned before when you said that for Kant, nature conforms to us, like we have to treat it as though it's us? Do you remember you said that? So is this what you mean?
Trying to do a two-sided argument. So again, on the one hand, Kantian transcendental determination of nature in general is a way in which we legislate what nature must be. On the other hand, I'm now suggesting at the empirical level, as we encounter particular ranges of objects, I'm trying to show that that transcendental determination of nature, which might lead us to think, I mean, after all, even in his own time, people thought Kant was a bit like Berkeley. Right? I mean, they thought he was some kind of crazy subjective idealist. And I'm suggesting he's not even nearly like Berkeley. He's nothing of a subjective idealist at all. But you don't get the depth of his commitment to trying to understand how mind and world connect without the issue of of reflective judgment, again, because from the point of view of the transcendental determination of experience, there really is a tight fit of concept and object. And that's why I'm suggesting that this retells the story by opening a space between concept and object to give the object a potential such that as we experiencing it, we are not merely narcissistically re-experiencing our own mental powers, but rather the attunement of our mental powers to what exists independently of them. And the question is, what do I mean by independently of them? That's exactly what needs to be shown by a theory of a judgment of taste, how that independence gets going, how far it reaches. So I'm trying not to say we determine nature. Right. Okay. Now, in order to get to this question, I want to do a detour. Because there's another problem we haven't talked about, which is also about the mind's relationship to particular objects, and is also a problem of reflective judgment, namely the problem of organisms. Before I talk about aesthetic judgment in the first introduction, I need to talk about the question of teleological judgment in the first introduction. Yeah, it's getting a bit warm. It's getting sauna-like again. All those years of thinking about Kristeva, you can open the door. Okay, so for the first introduction, it's paragraphs 6, 7, and 9. And at least for the next 15 or 20 minutes or so, just in case you want to stop taking notes and relax and speed up, go to sleep, I'm going to be drawing on the account of organism that I have in my essay on Kant and Sertini, and against what those bodies. Start with the problem again. The actual subsuming of objects and events under concepts and laws is a work of determining judgment. For determining judgment, Kant says, all explanation just is mechanical explanation. Absolutely fundamental to understanding Kant is for Kant, all real explanation is mechanical explanation, that is, explanation in terms of laws of the cause and effect, but mechanical also means ultimately about body's emotion. He really doesn't mean that, I think. And as he puts it in the first introduction, page 218, the operations of determining judgment occur as if wishing perhaps to have everything reduced to a mechanical kind of explanation. That is, Kant thinks that there's a drive in our intellect to explain things causally and mechanically. He says that, in fact, this way of explaining things works well for certain ranges of objects, earths, stones, minerals, anything that is a mere aggregate, is suitable for classification under empirical laws as a system of nature, even if they do not individually manifest the form of a system. So he says, we just assume, which is what we already discussed at level 3, that even, you know, it's a dirty piece of coal, but finally it's going to belong to an elegant system of law-likeness, of laws. When nature's products are aggregates, and nature is operating mechanically as mere nature, we have only a portion of the natural world. There are other types of items in the natural world, and Kant mentions flowers, or the inner structure of plants and animals, which, I want to be very careful here, which appear to consciousness as being incapable of being explained by mechanical natural laws alone. And the reason for this as Christel Fricke nicely states the thesis, for such items, the interaction of the parts cannot be explained mechanically because the completeness of the parts cannot be explained by means of their mechanical relations without having recourse to the representation of the whole system. So classically, I mean, just, you know, this is just standard Aristotelian stuff, right? You understand the heart, right? Not by, as it were, getting the mechanical laws about how it beats, but understanding the function of the heart, right, in carrying oxygen through the all that kind of stuff. So, what we have is that we cannot even say what an item is apart from the function or role it plays in the system of which it is a part. That is, the notion of a heart cannot, as it were, stand outside of bodies and their systems and what they accomplish. So for organic objects, we require a structure not of universal to particular, but of whole to part. Think of it another way. Aggregates that make up the stuff of the world, aggregates have surfaces, but no boundaries. By which I mean you take a piece of coal and you cut it in half, you still have two pieces of coal. You crush it, you get coal dust. I mean, you break it down, you still get the same stuff. However, take Oscar the Pussycat. Cut it in half. You don't have two cats. In fact, you don't have a cat at all, right? So there's something about its surface that is a boundary. in the sense that there it's right to speak, with respect of living organic things, of an inside and an outside, and of wholes and parts. Because living things must be both organized from the perspective of the whole and self-organizing from the perspective of the interplay of the parts, paragraph 65, they can be comprehended as possible neither in accordance with pure mechanical laws nor as artifacts, that is, objects produced through acts of freedom. But according to Kant, those two modes of comprehension exhaust the possibilities of objectively cognizing living beings by a discursive intellect like our own. What does he mean by discursive intellect? He means an intellect in which the what he calls the analytically universal or abstract concept precedes and so determines the meaning of the sensible particulars that fall under it. Now, this is puzzling, and the puzzle may be just Kant. I'll say the reason why I think Kant may be off base here. But for Kant, he thinks we can think about nature by thinking about explaining things mechanically, or we can think about human beings by thinking about acting in accordance with purposes, intentions. We have an idea of a house, we make the house. What we don't have, he says, is any way of understanding anything whose character is self-organizing. He says the idea of something that is self-organizing has nothing analogous to any causality known to us. Paragraph 65. In this sense, Kant thinks that living nature is both opaque and inscrutable. And we can ask the question, we should ask the question, we'll ask it again when we come to paragraph 65 to whatever it is, 72, and talks about this stuff. Is living nature in principle scrutable, comprehensible, or is there something fundamentally inscrutable about living nature? Now the question is how to ask this question in a good way. And I'll try, maybe even today, to suggest one way of trying to think about it that may give it some shape. But I take it it's a real question. And Kant was absolutely adamant in thinking that in itself, the notion of something simply being alive, a living thing, was unexplainable, inscrutable, and opaque. Now that said, he equally thought that if we simply used our existing mechanical laws, we're going to get nowhere. So in order to cognize living things, we must judge them as purposive, since their complexity of form exceeds the grasp of mechanical explanation. Yeah, Todd. No, because all we are doing by doing that, that is learning how the genome works, is learning what the mechanisms are, but we still, and here's where the area of debate is. It looks as if each step in the advance of biological sciences, modern biological science, involves the use of mechanical explanation, uses of bubble chemistry. It's really all about chemistry got back in fashion again. That seems to be true. However, what they are discovering is simply how living things work. But they're still presupposing the idea of living thing, and to the degree to which they block out that it's a living thing, they treat it as if it's a dead thing, right? So there's some ways in which certain branches of biology, I would argue, really reduce the living to the dead. Right? But there are certain other bits of it which emphatically don't do that, especially work in ecological sciences, right? Really do deal with a living habitat. And there are good arguments to show that you cannot reduce biology to, as it were, just the model of long-term evolutionary mechanics. The best book on this topic is John Dupré's The Disorder of Things, which is really trying to say exactly why, no matter what the role of mechanics is, that biology cannot be reduced to physics, and therefore there's something irreducible about the living. That doesn't answer the question about scrutability, right? It just raises it. My question is, do we know what scrutability is here? Yeah.
Well, the answer to his question is just that mathematical form doesn't deal with the thing as self-organizing at all. It simply deals with mathematical algorithm, how to produce that form in the computer, not with how it generates itself through the substrate, which is metabolism, self-organizing.
Right, which is, again, Kant's puzzle, exactly where Kant thought there was a limit, right? We can do a mimesis of the living
mathematically,
but we can't do is the living, right? So even where we talk about this work in the University of Chicago about trying to look at the origins of life, but that never is about an explanation of life. It's simply a reproduction of an imagination of what the original conditions were like in which life arose, and sure enough, you generate enough complexity, and sure enough, something like life suddenly emerges. Does that mean you've explained life mechanically? I think not. Huge topic. Does Adam, you look like you're ready to...
I will come here after.
Okay. But this puzzle, I should say, and the difficulty in answering it was what my PhD was about. So I'm still suffering now, 6 or 7 weeks later, just... So, Kant thinks then that we must judge living things as purposive, since their complexity of form exceeds the grasp of mechanical explanation, while acknowledging that there is something inexplicable in the principle of purposiveness employed. It is the combination of how, and I want to be very clear about his argument here, how we must think about living things in partial terms, and the ultimate opacity of the principle of teleological judgment that makes it reflective, that is, subjective, albeit not merely subjective. That is, and here's what makes it so weird, we must judge living things as if they're alive, is what Kant seems to be saying. While he says that is only as if. That is, we must judge them that way. Right? But it is only, and again, this is just like the case of science, it's an as if. That is, it's normative for our investigations, but it is not constitutive of the objects themselves. And he thinks it is not, again, constitutive of the objects themselves because we cannot conceive of or imagine a causality that is self-organizing. Now, one thing I do want...
Can we put this kind of question in kind of self-knowing thing, things? I mean, you are talking about the organization is kind of is a partial and not a universal or particular, but a partial and as a whole.
Right.
So, I mean, but for Kant, I mean, what this kind of thing appears in his discussion about time and space. Putting that we all experience a partial time and partial space, partial time, partial space. So therefore, but I mean, for mathematics, they are universal in this kind of intuition. But I mean, but
yeah,
this kind of intuition
good.
Is just partial, but not unique, but not as a whole thing yet.
What you say is absolutely right, but a red herring. You're absolutely right that he argues for space and time, that they too are have to be understood as intuitions in terms of part and whole, not of universal in particular. He does not think, however, that they are purposive or teleological or functional. Right? So it's a different kind of notion of part whole that is at work here. Organizing and self-organizing. Kant is perplexed by the notion of self-organizing. I would simply remind you of Hume's account of this problem in the Dialogues on Natural Religion, where there is an argument, indeed an argument that Kant himself is going to use in the second half of the Third Critique, namely an argument from design. If there is this holistic natural world, it appears as if designed, therefore there must be a designer. What's Hume's response? Do you remember Hume's response?
Well,
Yeah.
Well, I mean, in general terms, he says we don't have any experience with someone designing a world. That's exactly what I mean.
Not that one. I'm mentioning a much tighter argument against that inference. His argument is, and who organizes the ideas in God's mind? And the reason he asks that question is because he thinks the notion of if design-like, there must be a designer, actually thinks generates an infinite regress. That in fact the notion of self-organizing is more primitive and more basic. And that therefore the inference to designer in fact does nothing. Because at some point in the chain of explanation, you're going to have to get the notion of self-organization somewhere. Now, if I do this, let's do this. Now, there is a tremendous puzzle about Kant's analysis here. And I want to talk about the puzzle here of using the principle of purposiveness as if it were alive in terms of forcing us to think of things by using teleological and functional forms of explanation, that my first question is, why does Kant say that? And what's the necessity he's responding to? And I take it the necessity he's responding to is that living things present us with what I want to call an excess or surplus of formal integrity beyond what discursive thinking can accommodate. Now, it's this sensuous excess in living things that is more troubling for Kant's system than he acknowledges. He says the employment of teleological judgment permits us to begin the work of reflectively explaining living things. But this use of teleological explanation in one absolutely crucial sense comes too late. Before we can embark on the business of explaining living nature, there is a prior moment. And the prior moment is recognizing something as a living being. What Kant does not adequately conceptualize, I would argue that no philosopher has adequately conceptualized as yet. Aristotle and Bergson give it a go, but I think their accounts are deeply, deeply disappointing. And oddly enough, I cannot think of any other philosophers who really think hard about it. Namely, what is involved in seeing something as alive? Not as having consciousness. That's way too late. I'm interested in the prior question of what is involved in the experience of seeing something as living. So the question is not, so before we can even get going with the business of teleological explanation, we have to first recognize something as living and to distinguish what is living from the experience of mere things, of mere nature. Reflective judgments turn to teleological explanation, I'm suggesting, must be a second reflection. A reflection about our experience of things as living, that attempts to make sense of that initial encounter and do something with it. I don't, in fact, have an account of what it is to experiencing something as living. However, I do want to at least ponder briefly for a moment a passage from Wittgenstein where he's thinking about this problem. It's paragraph 284 of the Investigations. And it's a paragraph that has haunted me ever since Marie McGinn pointed out to me it, and then Stephen Mulhall convinced me it was the most important paragraph in the Investigations. In it, Wittgenstein says the following. Look at a stove and imagine it having sensation. One says to oneself, how could one so much as get the idea of ascribing a sensation to a thing? One might as well ascribe it to a number. And now look at a wriggling fly. And at once these difficulties vanish and pain seems to be able to get a foothold here, where before everything was, so to speak, too smooth for it. And so, too, a corpse seems inaccessible to pain. Our attitude, I want to take the word attitude, our attitude to what is alive and what is dead is not the same. And then he goes on to say, all, I think the all is fundamental, all our reactions are different. What's Wittgenstein claiming here? He is certainly claiming, this is the hardest thing of all to get a hold of, he's claiming that the predicate is alive does not operate like the predicate is red, is smooth, is green, is triangular. That it cannot operate that way, the way an ordinary predicate does, because the way in which we assign properties to objects presupposes our prior categorization of them as living, as dead, as mere things. So when he says all our reactions are different, he means to be saying something like, even if there are, to use his phrase, family resemblances between the smoothness of a stone and the smoothness of the skin under the arm, there is nonetheless a difference what's involved in feeling that smoothness. All our reactions are different. One is not even tempted to pinch a stone. The temptation to pinch sometimes is irresistible. Right? Or think of small boys with flies. Nothing more fun than picking off their wings. Why? Because they know absolutely the fly. So I want to suggest at least this, and I don't have an account of it. I'm not sure what it would mean to have an account of it.
what's his name, Michael Thompson in Pittsburgh, who's worried about this. But my suggestion is the notion of is living is a material a priori predicate. That it is a material a priori predicate because we come to it through our encounter with patterns of living beings. However, it is a priori because it is a condition for our use of concepts for things of that kind. So it cannot be used like ordinary predicates. Bunches of questions, yeah.
Now, would the point here be living, or would it be sensation? Because the capacity has sensation, because it would seem to imply in this relationship with plants, for example, that you could treat a plant the same way you treat a stone, you don't get any pleasure out of being a leaf off of the plant.
Right.
So is it the fact that it can react that we can somehow empathize with it, or is it...
So on the one hand, great question. So let me begin picking away at it, because I think it's a deep and difficult question. One of the things that Wittgenstein's interested here, and why I think it's so important for the whole unfolding of the investigations, is the investigations is not about mindedness. It's about bodiedness. And that the investigations is really an account that sensations belong not to consciousnesses, but to bodies of certain kinds. So you're absolutely right. He's interested in and his use of the fly is he's trying to push our capacities beyond the level of easy anthropomorphic identification. Despite the movie The Fly, flies are not easy to identify with. But yet again, as small children know, they do suffer, or they appear to suffer, and we treat them as capable of suffering. Otherwise, there's no pleasure in pulling off their wings and legs. So, that the living also includes that which has no sensation is one of the most difficult things to think coherently about. The person who I know thinks hardest about it is Matisse. The trick of all of Matisse's art is to treat plant likeness as the fundamental category in which to understand even the human world. And it's what makes his paintings so difficult and troubling and both also ravishing, right? That humans are plant-like and yet so I don't know how to answer your question except to say that plant-likeness is a stratum of livingness, but a livingness without sensation, but nonetheless, as every gardener knows, some things you have to, like children, be tough love. But sometimes they need delicacy, tender handling. And if you don't get that, then you don't know it's alive. You don't know how easily it can break, be killed, etc., etc. So sensation is one stratum of this. Living and dead seems another level. Yeah?
Yeah, does this not... to carry this into a stasis, the kind of desire to touch the work of art, to understand its living givenness, you know, that kind of...
Well...
Because there seems to be that kind of desire.
Okay, so at least some of the questions we have to think about in thinking about Kant, not to answer your question, but to raise the right questions, is first, the question I already posed, can we think coherently about art without thinking about the beauty of nature? And when we think about the beauty of nature, can we think about it coherently without thinking about at least part of it under the notion of living nature? And that raises the question, to bring it back to an old sawhorse of the arts, is the notion of organic form intrinsic to the arts or not? This is sometimes thought to be a bad theory of art, where artworks have organic form, are wholes with parts, and this was thought to be a bad metaphor, overly biological. Nowadays we're structural or analytic, you know, throw Roland Barthes and the new critics who put dead to it. Okay. I see why I'm getting looks. If we want to stay alive, then we need to leave now. We will pick up here next week. We're still on the first introduction, but we will begin the actual text next week.
Well, in part because not.